It is Thursday, May 28th, 2020, and it is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. As COVID-19 or novel coronavirus cases continue to climb in the country, here are today's numbers. Confirmed in the United States, we now have 1.74 million cases, up by 18,677 cases from yesterday. Fortunately, 372,000 people have recovered, and unfortunately, 102,000 people have died in the United States. That's up by 1,379 from yesterday. In response to the murder of Mr. George Floyd, violent protests erupted last night for a second night in Minneapolis. George Floyd, an African-American man, was seen on video pleading for medical assistance and saying that he could not breathe while pinned to the ground as an officer, Derek Chauvin, placed a knee upon his neck while detaining him. Minneapolis police identified the other officers as Thomas Lane, To Thao, and J. Alexander Koenig. All officers have since been fired. What are we to make of these new developments? Well, for insight into this, we go to the Twin Cities, and my first guest, he's a professor of political science at Hamline University, where he teaches American politics, and he's a professor of law specializing in election law at the University of Minnesota Law School. He's the author of Presidential Swing States, Why Only 10 Matter, and he joins us to discuss his latest piece entitled The Lesson of George Floyd, It's Time to Put the Minneapolis Police Department Under State Control. He is Professor David Schultz. David, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thanks for having me, and thanks to your audience.
So before we get to your latest piece, with your being in Minneapolis, give us an update on what's going on there.
Well, what's going on? First off, I live about 5 miles from the center of where the main demonstrations were occurring. And the first night and the second night, there's clearly legitimate demonstrations and protests against, you know, what from all appearances looks like to be almost an execution or strangulation of George Floyd. And so people are very angry, especially the people of color in Minneapolis. We're going to talk about sort of the history of the problems here. They came out to protest, but last night, that is on Wednesday night, it turned incredibly ugly in the sense that there is a percentage of the people who showed up who turned out to be looters, who did a variety of things, throw bricks, broke windows, looted several stores, set several places on fire, rocks were thrown, bottles thrown. And also what wound up happening is that there was like, I think a pawn shop, you know, in the area there where the owner trying to protect this place shot and killed somebody trying to enter in. And he was charged with a crime. And then what's also happened in the Twin Cities is that St. Paul, where I live, is right across the border, you know, right across the river. There were some looks like attempt at looting. And then the officer who was the person who was shown, Chauvin, basically strangulating Mr. Floyd. He lives in a suburb a few miles from here. And it looks like several hundred protesters showed up at his house and painted in red, I can't breathe, I can't breathe. So it sounds like it's spreading. And it looks like tonight already, from what I've been able to hear and talk to some of my friends who are defense attorneys, who kind of have their ears to the ground, that the protests are going to be even larger tonight, that is on Thursday night, than they were previous night.
As I mentioned in the opening, all four officers have been fired. It's reported that they were fired by Mayor Jacob Frey, but technically, I read, they were actually fired by the police chief, please help me with his name, Madera Arredondo?
Arredondo, correct. Arredondo, correct. Yes. The mayor really can't fire these officers, and partly because of the structure of city government in Minneapolis. The mayor is actually a what's called a weak mayor position. And so he pretty much asked the police chief to dismiss these people. And he did fire them instantaneously. But this is not going to solve the problem. That there's two things that's true about Minneapolis. A, it's got a policing problem. B, it has a race problem. And in the blog that I did, I talk about how if you go back well over 100 years ago, Lincoln Steffens, who was one of the classic muckraker journalists during the progressive era, wrote a famous article that talked about at the turn of the 20th century, like 1903, 1904, how out of control the police department was in Minneapolis. So it's had a legacy of this. And I want to combine this. I, about 20, 25 years ago, used to teach a class on police criminal and civil liability, you know, under what conditions you can hold police officers, you know, personally or civilly or criminally responsible. And I used to, I guess, tongue-in-cheek say that Minneapolis was a perfect teaching experiment for me in everything that you could do wrong. There was constant shootings back then. There were, I remember a story once where the police thought it would be perfectly okay to do a full body cavity strip search in public of somebody. Just horrific things. And there's this long pattern in the city of using excessive force against people of color, of basically doing all these kind of things. And what's true is what people thought what would happen is that thought that in 1978, there's a famous Supreme Court case that said cities could be sued for violations of civil rights like this. Minneapolis, like a lot of cities around the country, has paid out millions, and it's done nothing. It's changed nothing. So the people who are frustrated, whether white, black, Hmong, Asian, in Minneapolis, are very frustrated that here's a city with years and years of maltreatment and use of excessive force against people of color, and nothing is getting changed.
You mentioned the money being paid, and I think we might have mentioned this yesterday or the day before. As a result of the lawsuits, then we had cities insuring indemnifying themselves, mm-hmm. and putting limits on the amount of money that could be paid out in cases such as this. Then we had the situation in Baltimore where, and now I'm unfortunately drawing a blank on the gentleman's name, but where they broke his neck, the police broke his neck, and money was paid. And a lot of people thought this was going to be the watershed moment, that because of the amount of money that the city was going to be liable for, that this would force a change in police behavior. And we're finding that that is nowhere near the case.
That's exactly the issue across the country, is that cities, like I said, cities have paid out. We've had that occur, and it hasn't changed behavior. We occasionally get a police officer who's charged with and maybe occasionally convicted of a crime for doing this. That's not changing it. So we clearly need something more fundamental in terms of changing police behavior and police practices, because for the most part, the civil fines don't work. The law on police use of force hugely favors police officers, thanks to the Supreme Court. And so nothing seems to be working at this point. Now, I don't know what the global solution is, but what I've argued for Minneapolis, what should happen or what should have happened at some point, is that there had to be, or there should have been, a civil lawsuit that basically required the city to reform its process and procedures. Or, this is what I'm arguing now, I don't think you can trust the city of Minneapolis to reform itself. I think people have given up, and I actually think at this point it either needs to be taken over by the state or put in some kind of receivership and run by somebody else. But I don't think anybody has confidence at this point that the city has the will or the capacity to be able to make the kind of changes it needs to occur. And this may be the unfortunate conclusion that we're coming with across the country at this point, is that the Baltimores, the East St. Louis's, you know,
and the Oaklands, the Oakland, Californias, because they were in receivership as well.
Exactly. That's exactly what I think has to happen at this point, is we need to go in that direction.
And Freddie Gray was the name of the young man that I was trying to think of in Baltimore. You know, one of the things that I think has to change is the response of police unions in situations like this. I haven't heard any statements from the police union out of Minnesota. If you have, please clarify. But more times than not, police unions come to the defense of officers, even in heinous acts such as this. And in my opinion, by their speaking on behalf of the rank and file, they are, by saying, you know, we're sticking by our guy or woman, they are condoning this behavior. And until we start hearing from police unions that this type of behavior is not going to be tolerated and is not going to be defended or supported, that is one element to me that would go a long way in changing the mentality, because this is a systemic problem. And this, and that's something that I think a lot of people have to appreciate, is that this is a systemic problem with policing in the United States.
You're right. It's systemic, and I'm going to use a slightly different word, but it's going to say the same thing. It's a cultural problem. And what I mean by it, I think we're saying the same thing here. It's imbued in the culture of many, if not most, police departments in the country. And you're right. You know, I am very hesitant to attack unions, but in situations like this, where even in Minneapolis, the union response on this has been to say, don't prejudge, don't jump to any kind of conclusions at this point. There was no condemnation of saying this is really unacceptable behavior, et cetera, et cetera. But you're right. It winds up giving the impression, if not the reality, that the police unions are supporting this type of behavior. And it reinforces this kind of culture. And what happens now, people often talk about the thin blue line, the idea that the police are kind of what, circle the wagons to protect themselves. This is exactly what we're seeing here going on in Minneapolis right now. So something needs to be done to break, as you say, the systemic problem. For me, I'd maybe call it a cultural problem, but we're both, again, saying the same thing. There's something imbued in the nature of the practices. And what's really interesting here, okay, the state of Minnesota has a board certification for police officers, for you to be able to wear your badge and so forth. And I was at least pleased that they did this. They came out and said that under no circumstances is it an approved practice to subdue anybody by putting a knee onto the neck and basically choking somebody. So somewhere along the line here, the police department learned that or accepted the fact that this type of behavior is okay. And were it not for a civilian having taped this, the story that would have come out, or taped, you might say, recorded on cell phone, had it not recorded on the cell phone, the story that would have come out from the police is that suspect was resisting arrest and we had to take appropriate action to subdue him. There's just this, and this is what needs to be changed, this culture of thinking that you can just do whatever you want. And that's what Minneapolis is doing.
And to those who want to question how we know that this is a cultural or systemic issue, if you look at the tape, the officer that was closest to the former officer that was closest to the scene, Tao Tho, and if that's not the proper pronunciation, please help me, he did absolutely nothing. He stood there for 10 minutes while Mr. Floyd died in the street. J. Alexander Koenig did nothing for 10 minutes while George Floyd laid in the street and died. Thomas Lane did absolutely nothing to go over to the officer that had his, Chauvin, that had his knee on Mr. Floyd's neck. None of them tapped him out and said, enough, enough, we can handle this another way. None of them tapped him. That's how you know they're standing by and watching this is a cultural / systemic issue. You mentioned in your piece, former state prosecutor, now Senator Amy Klobuchar, who, by the way, is on the short list for former Vice President Biden's VP running mate as he pursues the Democratic nomination. It's interesting to me, and some may see this as a nit, but in her tweet about this murder. She writes, quote, "Justice must be served for this man. Justice must be served for our community, and justice must be served for our country," end quote. She does not mention Mr. Floyd by name. Instead of noting that he died at the hands of the police or through police violence, she instead uses the term "this loss of life" or "an African-American man dying." This was not a car accident or some innocuous event. I thought her initial tweet was way too passive and was way too political. It was by omission, it was almost pro-police. Your thoughts, sir?
Well, she has a problem here. She wants to be vice president of the, well, she wanted to be president, of course. She wants to be vice president. However, stories came out earlier this year, in fact, late last year also, that she was the county prosecutor, district attorney in Hennepin County, in Minneapolis is in Hennepin County, in the early part of the 20th century. And there were many situations where there were officer actions, including shootings, that she could have decided to prosecute and decided not to. In fact, she prosecuted not a single one. She ran as a prosecutor of that get tough on crime, you know, crack down on crime sort of era. And her response, I thought, was really interesting, too, because her response to George Floyd killing was hardly a strong condemnation, hardly coming out very forceful. It hits at this blind spot that has caused problems for her while running for president and now vice president, that within the communities of color, she is not looked upon as somebody who is sympathetic on the issue of race and policing. And this tweet or whatever of hers, press release, is really just sort of further reinforcement of that lack of awareness on her part that there's a problem here. And she in part was part of that problem when she was a prosecutor.
You mentioned the historic nature of the problem with policing in Minnesota. And I find that interesting because Minnesota, surprisingly, has been a state that has been incredibly welcoming to a very diverse ethnic community. You've got I think, Vietnamese, you've got Hung, you've got people from Somalia. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, comes from your state. And I was surprised when I came to start to realize how diverse and welcoming the state has been.
Yeah, it's an interesting juxtaposition. I mean, Minneapolis, for example, in the public school system, I think there's 100 languages spoken. St. Paul, across the river where I live, I think the K-12 has like 120 languages spoken. St. Paul's school system is a majority non-white. I think Minneapolis is pretty close to that. So they're incredibly diverse cities, but what they're going through is this incredible transition and trying to figure out how to adjust to a rapidly changing racial demographic. And Minnesota is not coming through this very well. The state of Minnesota in general, including Minneapolis, has the highest racial disparities in terms of educational outcomes, prison incarceration, healthcare, employment, or rather unemployment, and a whole bunch of other indices that were very welcoming on one level. But there's this famous phrase in Minnesota called Minnesota nice, that Minnesotans will be nice to you and smile, but underneath, if you talk to people of color, they'll say that niceness masks a deep-seated racism. And there is that aspect that is there. And that's partly what's coming out in Minneapolis, that Minneapolis is one of the most liberal cities in the United States on one level, but also one of the most heavily segregated and deeply, apparently entrenched on a lot of measures, very racially disparate.
Professor David Schultz, as always, thank you so much for your analysis here. You being there for me has been just an incredible, you're just an incredible resource, and your analysis is incredibly clear and really, really appreciated, David. Stay safe and healthy to you and your family, and look forward to having you back.
Thank you very much. Thanks to the audience. Goodbye.
Thank you. Folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, the numbers are out. 2 million more Americans have filed new unemployment claims, pushing those due to the coronavirus toll past 40 million people. How do we make sense of this? For insight, we turn to my next guest. He's a man with a PhD in political economy. He teaches economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California, and he's the author of the book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Policy from Reagan to Trump. And he has a new piece entitled, and now, Jack, help me out, because I just forgot the name of the new piece.
Two Fictions of Mainstream Economics. And the thrust here is, we're beginning to hear that from the Republicans in Congress that, oh, the problem we've got is that people are getting too much unemployment benefits, and it's keeping them from going back to work in the economy for recovering. That's all just the latest version of this long-standing, centuries-long mainstream economic notion that it's workers and not taking pay cuts sufficient that is really the cause of a weak recovery. And that's really what the focus is, debunking that silly notion. That's a companion notion to other silly notions like free trade benefits everybody and business tax cuts create jobs and so forth. So that's the thrust of that piece.
The other piece that I was thinking of and drawing a blank on was Heroes Act, Dead on Arrival Part 1, which we'll get to in un momento. Anyway, folks, that's Dr. Jack Rasmus. That's the voice that you heard. So Jack, roughly 2.1 million Americans filed new claims for unemployment benefits as the president and governors across this country are trying to reopen the economy. This is according to data that's released by the Labor Department today. In the week ending May 23, a seasonally adjusted 2,123,000 Americans filed for unemployment. That's falling from the revised total of 2,446,000 filed the week before. This might sound like a sophomore question, but what do these numbers say to you, Dr. Jack Rasmus?
Well, they say to me that the unemployment rate is far higher than they've been reporting it. You know, we've got 40 million collecting unemployment benefits. There are unemployed who haven't yet been able to collect unemployment benefits. Remember, that number of 40 million plus is lagged by at least a week. So we got another week of people filing who should probably be added to that. Who knows, hundreds of thousands of more. And you got to remember, too, that not all unemployed are getting benefits. And more importantly, or just as importantly, there are at least 5 million people more who dropped out of the labor force. And the way the U.S. government calculates unemployment, if you've just given up and dropped off of the labor force, you're not considered in the unemployment calculations. So, you know, what are those numbers? At least 5-6 million in the last couple of months have dropped out of the labor force. So we're really looking at somewhere between 46 and 50 million people who are jobless. 40 million collecting benefits, but another 6-7 million, you know, who are either applying for benefits or have given up and dropped out altogether. You know, this is like 30% unemployment, perhaps, or damn close to it. And in Congress, what are they doing? The Republicans are talking about, oh, we gave people too much unemployment benefits. The $600 supplement is too much, and it's keeping them from going to work. Therefore, there's this big push in Congress not to extend the additional supplement unemployment benefits when they run out in July. And we got these other schemes going on in Congress that instead of extending unemployment benefits for people, we're going to give subsidies to the employers. In other words, we're going to substitute unemployment insurance benefits for giving employers a bigger wage subsidy. Is this the beginning of the end of unemployment insurance?
Now that right there is a phenomenal question, and some might say you've uncovered a scheme. Before we get to that, let me ask this question, and you touched on it, but I want to zero in on this. Do you have any sense as to how many of these 2.1 million people filing new claims are those that are recently unemployed versus those who have been out of work for a while but have been unable until now to have their claims processed? Is the processing of claims due to the systems being overloaded, is that still a problem?
It's still a problem in some places. So, part of the number of the 2 million plus is undoubtedly people who have been struggling in previous weeks to try to file and get approved for unemployment benefits. What portion of that 2 million represents those people who have been trying to get through the system? I don't know. And I don't think there is a statistic on that that's public. But what we got is a mix of both. We got people who've been knocking on the door trying to get approved for unemployment, and then we've got people who are totally new, who are still being unemployed. We got kind of a second wave that's emerging here of unemployment. One is obviously the shutdowns and the virus effect, but now we've got businesses that are beginning to default and go bankrupt, and who, for economic reasons, independent of the crisis with the virus, are beginning to experience unemployment. And this will continue as the economy, quote, opens up. Businesses will open up in many places with skeleton forces, employees, and a limited demand. People aren't going to jump in, and consumers and households, and go back and do everything they were doing in terms of spending before. They're going to be very reticent about the spending. They're going to, because of the uncertainty of the future, they're spending just on the necessities oftentimes. And, can businesses, particularly small businesses, even when they open up, survive very long on this limited consumption, limited demand for their products? They can probably go for some period here. But as we continue throughout the year, you're going to see more and more smaller businesses go under because they can't operate just on limited consumption, limited demand, limited margins. So we got an economic effect that's kind of beginning to take place here. Plus, we got more and more companies defaulting and going bankrupt over time. It's obvious. You read about it a lot in big box retail, the Pennies, JCPenney's, and Neiman Marcus's, and so forth. That's going to continue. We're going to see it with hotel chains and restaurant chains. We're going to see it, of course, with the airlines who are going to consolidate almost for sure. We're going to see it in Hertz, cars, rental cars filing bankruptcy. Well, whenever this happens, they're laying off massive amount of workers here, and that effect is going to continue throughout the rest of the year.
There are multiple issues here, many of which you've just articulated, and two to me, which are fairly simple and very important. To your point, businesses reopening and then people trusting enough to return to them. Consumer confidence in a couple of different things. One, their health. When I start going back out and going either to the strip mall, going to the larger malls, trying to go out here and enjoy a meal at a restaurant, is the person who's sitting next to me coughing, does that person have allergies or does that person have COVID-19? The other level of confidence has to do with, is the $50 that I'm spending for this meal, am I going to need that $50 next week to keep the lights on in my house. All of that as we're seeing reports that the stock market is rebounding, and which we know the stock market is a future projection, not necessarily a photograph or timestamp of the immediate moment. Does all of that make sense?
Well, let me take that last point, the stock market. It's not a reflection of the real economy anymore. You know, 80-85% of all the trades going on in the stock market are by institutional buyers and sellers, you know, hedge funds and so forth. And the retail buyers are in what's called passive indexing, and they just follow the market as it goes up or down. You know, what's boosting the stock market is the fact that they know, investors know, that $1.7 trillion of loans has flowed into big corporations. $1.7 trillion. Well, we can, small business, maybe about four or 500 got that. But, you know, like $1.5 trillion. And they are sitting on it. There's all kind of indications that big corporations are sitting on these loans that they've gotten. Many of them don't need it, the loans. They've loaded up on cash by issuing over $1 trillion additional new corporate bonds. They've drawn down their credit lines by hundreds of billions of dollars. They've gotten new tax cuts here, $650 billion. In the CARES Act in March. So they're sitting on a mountain of cash. Big corporations are sitting on a mountain of cash. Now, you got some like the airlines and so forth that are really hurting, perhaps, but most of them have this massive amount of cash, and the stock market knows that that money is going to flow into the stock markets and into financial markets and has begun to do so. So what drives the stock market is all this massive cash flow that comes from big investors, big corporations, the wealthy 1%, who are, you know, gathering up this this massive amount of cash. For example, here's a statistic: just in institutional money funds in the last month or so have increased by business deposits in these international institutional money funds have deposited $1 trillion. Now, where did they get an extra $1 trillion simply to park it in money funds? The same thing with commercial banks. The business deposits in commercial banks, which run about 5% historically on average, are now 16%. They're gathering a lot of cash, including from these loans, and they're sitting on it, and the stock market knows that that money is going to start flowing their way. That's what's driving the stock market and not the economy.
When you say that that money is going to start flowing their way, what do you mean by that?
Well, that means that businesses are corporations, you know, the big corporations sitting on this mountain of cash have to put that somewhere. They're going to invest it somewhere short term or medium term. Well, the good place to put it and where they often put it is in a stock market because they can get in and out of the stock market real quick. They're not going to commit it to a long-term investment to expand their production in the U.S. that would require hiring and so forth and jobs. They're not going to commit it there because that's harder to back out of. And they are very uncertain about the future, as you said. Both businesses and consumers are uncertain about where this economy is really going. And they're both battening down the hatches and waiting to see. They're being very conservative about investing, except in markets they can jump in and out of, businesses I'm talking about and professional investors, and the same with households. As you indicated, they're very uncertain about whether they're going to have a job, whether there's going to be a second wave, which is going to be, and what the future is going to bring. So they're going, and they are already very cautious. That means we aren't going to get a robust recovery because of business investment and because of consumers being very careful. And, of course, we're not going to get it because of exports increasing dramatically when the rest of the global economy is slowing down and Trump is creating another trade or trade war or worse with China here. So it's not coming there. And Congress doesn't want to spend. The Republicans don't want to spend anymore. So where is the Where is the stimulus coming from? It's not coming from anywhere.
I'm trying to paint a picture for my audience about what the future looks like. And I keep going back to these black and white grainy footage of the Great Depression, people standing around barrels with lit with fire, warming their hands as they're waiting to go, as they're standing in bread lines and at soup kitchens, and they've got on these tattered clothes and just lines. I'm trying to figure out, in many places we're there, except instead of people standing in line, they're sitting in their cars. But is that where we're headed?
Well, it all depends on what Congress is able to do to stimulate the economy. And there's a big war going on now between the Republican Senate and the Democrat House. The Democrats want to stimulate the economy in a number of ways, but the Republicans don't. You know, the Republicans, as far as they're concerned, Mitch McConnell's concerned, they've given trillions plus dollars to businesses, and they want to wait and see. And they don't want to give any more to average households and consumers. They want to cut off the unemployment supplement here come July. And it looks like they're going to, you know, achieve that. They say, well, let's wait and see. Well, because businesses are fat. And they're loaded up and they want to wait and see what happens. And they really don't care that much about households. They want to put the squeeze on the unemployed to go back to work. But there's no jobs. There's very few jobs to go back to work to. They're going to find out. And a lot will depend on over the next 6 months, what kind of government programs, stimulus programs can get through. I'm not very optimistic about that. And then, of course, we have what's coming up in November and what may be a very serious political crisis in this country come November. And that will depress the economy even more, create even more uncertainty. So there's a lot of uncertainty out there and nothing really clarifying it, which means you're not going to get a V-shaped recovery with all this uncertainty. What you're going to get is now a sort of flattening out of the decline. It won't decline as much. It may even rise a little bit over the summer. Not very much. You know, we've contracted 40%. Maybe you get a 10% boost back. Trump will say, oh, that means we got a big recovery going on. No, 10% of 40% is not a big recovery. But then after that, you could have a very sort of bouncing around the bottom, not really growing and not really falling. But at this very low equilibrium is what we say in economics, where you're way below the full employment economy. And that bouncing around can go on for some time. You could have short shadow relapses and weak recoveries. In other words, it's going to look very much like a W shape, not a V-shaped kind of recovery.
Quickly, if you would, talk about the HEROES Act. You mentioned the CARES Act. You've talked about the actions of Congress. The Republicans really seem to be sticking to this trickle-down voodoo economics from the Reagan era, as opposed to what I've been calling for is the bottom-up economic recovery. Give money to the average American, and they'll do with it what needs to be done in terms of investing back into the economy, because people need to eat, they need to buy shoes, and they need refrigerators. Talk about the HEROES Act and why you see problems with that.
Well, the problem with the HEROES Act is the Republicans and McConnell don't want to provide any more mitigation or further stimulus to households. In fact, you know, they want to take it away. And they see that, you know, they've loaded up business with over $1 trillion of loans, and they want to see if business is going to invest. They actually believe the fiction that if you give more money to businesses, they will automatically, with that extra money, reinvest it. Well, that's a fiction of mainstream economics that just isn't true. What they'll do is hoard it, you see. They'll sit on it and wait and see whether the household and consumers will start purchasing again. Well, they won't purchase again if you reduce their unemployment benefits and if the return to employment is very slow and doesn't occur, you know, rapidly here. So we're going to be stuck. The HEROES Act has provisions to bail out the states, for example, who have lost tremendous revenues because of the shutdown here and the lack of consumption. And it wants to continue the unemployment benefits. It wants to provide more supplemental checks to households because, you know, the CARES Act that was passed in March was only understood to be an eight-week mitigation. It wasn't a stimulus to the economy. Well, now, you know, the Democrats, to their credit, are trying to stimulate the economy, but the Republicans and McConnell say, no way, we're not going to do it. We're going to, quote, wait and see. You know, and that's how you get there's a lot of flux going on in backroom negotiations now between the two parties on what goes into HEROES Act. But the real stimulus Republicans don't want. They want to redirect the HEROES Act into more subsidies for businesses, more money for businesses, move the money around, take it out of unemployment insurance extension, and provide wage subsidies to businesses so that they will keep their employees and not lay off even more. Well, what does that mean for the 47 million without jobs? It doesn't do anything for them. The Republicans are kind of saying, well, we don't care about that. Let's just make sure businesses remain flush with cash.
And what we'll have to see is how willing and able are the Democrats, Schumer and Pelosi and the crew, to hold the line for the people instead of acquiescing just to get something done. Dr. Jack Rasmus, as always, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your analysis. Look forward to having you back. Stay healthy and safe to you and your family.
Same to you and everyone else.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it, Jack. All right, folks, you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. How is it that in America, supposedly the greatest country in the world, hunger programs slow start leaves millions of children waiting? In America, child hunger is soaring, but 2 months after Congress approved billions to replace school meals, only 15% of eligible children have received the benefits. For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. She's a member of the National Family Farming Coalition. She's on the board of directors of the Northeast Organic Farming Association of New York. She co-chairs the policy committee and represents the Farming Association Interstate Council on the board of the Agricultural Justice Project. She's also a writer on organic agriculture. She is Ms. Elizabeth Henderson. Ms. Henderson, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Well, thank you for inviting me to your show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us. One of the things that I just have not been able to understand is over the last couple of weeks, seeing news footage of Midwest farmers plowing under crops, Minnesota dairy farmers flushing milk down the drain, and that then juxtaposed to people in lines waiting for bags of food for hours, only to have the food in the lines run out an hour after the program opens. Help me understand why we have people in the midst of this pandemic and some of the highest rates of unemployment in this country going hungry in America. I don't get it.
Well, I think to make sense of what's happening, you have to kind of look at the bigger picture of what's happened to the food system in the United States and around the world. Since World War II, really, corporate domination and concentration in fewer hands has been progressing really steadily to the point where most of that meat that you saw that was the animals that are being so-called euthanized, in other words, murdered and then composted or chopped up and buried, those animals are going through meat processors that together, three or four companies control almost all of the meat that's sold in all of the grocery stores all over the country. And two of those, the biggest companies, JBS and Smithfield, aren't even owned by corporations in the United States. JBS is Brazilian, and Smithfield belongs to a Chinese company. But I've heard more recently that that company is actually controlled by Goldman Sachs. So maybe it actually is U.S. money, but you know, it's a transnational corporation that has no responsibility to the people here who are doing the work on the farms and in those slaughterhouses and processing plants. So because of that corporate concentration, the supply chain is divided up in very particular ways that funnels the food this way or that. So that meat was to have gone to restaurants and school lunches, school food, you know, places, public places of eating, and those places are closed. Farms that sell either dairy farms, like the organic dairy farms in New York State, have not been dumping any of their milk. Why is that? Because their milk has been going directly to bottles that are sold in stores to consumers. But the dairy milk that was packaged to go either to restaurants or to big eating centers couldn't be immediately repackaged into the kind of container that would go to a grocery store.
Let me jump in if I could. I heard Sonny Perdue, the director of Department of Agriculture, say that packaging was the issue. And I didn't understand how, again, starving people in America, and Sonny Perdue is going to come on TV and say, well, we just can't get them the food they need because of packaging. That to me just didn't make sense. So if you could explain to me, and it may be a simplistic question, but explain why the packaging makes a difference.
It's not just the packaging. It's the whole supply chain that was set up to go from those farms to the processor to food services or schools or restaurants. So that supply chain is a different one from the supply chain that goes to stores or directly to people.
Okay.
And they couldn't restructure that very quickly. I don't know if they can restructure it at all or if they care.
Now, maybe that's the part of the answer because, you know, I see, for example, the Army Corps of Engineers. We can debate the military all we want, but the one thing that the Army can do is move something from point A to point B.
That's exactly right. If the will is there, it can be done.
Thank you.
But the will isn't there. And what we have is a food system where most of the jobs of the people who do the work, the farm workers, the people who sell the groceries, who clean up the restaurants, wash the dishes, things like that, are people of color. We have structural racism in this country that sorts people out, and the jobs at the bottom that pay the least go to people of color. The jobs at the top, the managers, are white men. Why do so many children depend upon lunches in school for their main meal or breakfast and lunch? It's because their parents aren't making enough money to buy food themselves. The minimum wage in this country does not provide a wage for someone that allows them to feed their family and rent a decent apartment or buy a home in any of the cities in this country. The people who are fighting for 15, the food workers at McDonald's and places like that, they have absolutely the right idea that the minimum wage should be, well, $15 actually isn't high enough to be a living wage. That's a living wage out where I live in Wayne County, New York, out in the country. But it wouldn't be a living wage in San Francisco or New York City, or even a city like here where I spend a lot of my time, in Rochester, New York. The living wage to actually be able to afford an apartment and feed your family decently would be more like $25, $30 an hour. But people aren't getting that. So in the city of Rochester, I think it's something like 90% of the children qualify for free lunches because their families are earning so little.
You mentioned the will to do this, and of the amount of money that was provided in this, about $3 billion, as I understand it, the companies that are designed to distribute food, such as the Sysco's of the world, they were locked out of the opportunity to bid on the contract. I think it was only 5 days that they had to bid on the contract. And the Sysco's of the world, the companies that have the nationwide network to distribute food, they weren't awarded contracts, while companies who did not have the background in doing this type of work, many of them were given contracts. Did you see that go ahead.
Actually, some of the companies that were given contracts are very reasonable ones that do have connections with barns and can deliver to individual families.
Mm-hmm.
But this is part of a scheme that the current administration has had. Rather than raising the SNAP payments, which would have been the really simple way to solve this food problem, If you double or triple the amount of money that people who were unemployed or who had been getting SNAP could get, then people would have been able to afford to go to the store and buy what they needed. Or they could have gone to farmers markets, which take SNAP payments. But online SNAP payments can only be made to Walmart and Amazon. They're not allowed to go to farms that are ready to sell food to people directly.
I see. So as someone who's involved in the Northeast Organic Farming Association, how have you all, and not only your particular organization, but other similar organizations across the country, how have you all been providing food to those who need it most in this country?
Well, we've been doing two things. One is NOFA is part of several national coalitions, the National Family Farm Coalition and the National Organic Coalition. And we have been dinning till we can't stop talking in D.C. to all of our representatives saying, you have to make payments to the people who are unemployed. And rather than have them be unemployed, let them stay on their jobs and be furloughed so they won't lose their health insurance. And then make paid leave for all of the people who work in the food system. So the essential workers, like the farm workers, 50% of the farm workers in the whole country are undocumented people. They aren't getting a penny of any of this stimulus money. They're getting no help at all, and they're not entitled to any kind of SNAP payments or health insurance or anything. So the other kind of work that NOFA and our allies has been doing is assisting our farmers in finding the most efficient ways to sell direct to people and take orders online and deliver either at farmers markets or through community-supported agriculture projects, deliver to people's homes. But because of the way the whole agriculture system is structured, if you took all the small-scale and organic farms in the country, we could not, at this time, feed most of the people. The money has been invested on pushing farms to get bigger and bigger to grow soybeans and corn, and that is the main concern of people like the Secretary of Agriculture, Perdue. That's what he's busy with. He's telling farms, get bigger or get out. That's been their line for 30 years.
We have just about a minute. So to your point about soybeans and corn, Is that because the focus for big agribusiness is export and the domestic market is secondary?
That the corn and soybean goes for export, but it also goes as cheap food for the big processing plants that we were talking about at the beginning, so that we can have cheap meat that's raised on these factory farms and then put through enormous processing plants and delivered wrapped to your grocery store. We need to restructure the whole farming system so that people of color and Native American people and small-scale farmers of all colors and ethnic backgrounds can build local food systems that are much more resilient and that will and that care about the people in their neighborhood and feeding them and having a relationship and building a different kind of society than what we've been living through before this terrible pandemic, which in some ways was caused by the industrialization of agriculture, which has pushed farms into areas that bring massive scales of chickens and hogs into close contact with zoonotic, that is, wild animal-initiated diseases that spread these pandemics to people all over the world.
Elizabeth Henderson, I have to stop you there, member of the National Family Farming Coalition. Thank you so much. That was clear. You finally answered my questions. I greatly, greatly appreciate it. Folks, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.